Thank you very much. Thank all of you for being here today. So many of you that I have the feeling I'm here at a political endeavor, but I'm not running for anything. Now, I am pleased because of the subject. The subject is urgent, has always been, especially now. And of course, the question is, what makes us moral? Next question is, what is moral? What is moral, really? What makes a person moral? What makes a society moral? Was I born moral, or was I born to be moral? And my topic has been actually emphasize the Abrahamic concept of morality, meaning in the Bible. That means what is common to at least three monotheistic religions. It's not so simple, because what is moral to one may be immoral to another. Just like hope is, my hope may be based on someone else's despair. Is my hope therefore conditioned by it? Is it an answer to it? Or perhaps it is already immoral, simply because it created immoral situations. Now, in the Bible, of course, we start right away with our ancestors. Adam and Eve, were they moral? In the beginning, they had no idea what it meant to be moral. It's only when God told them, you have two trees, a tree of knowledge, a tree of life, don't eat from the fruit of knowledge. Why God did that is for him to answer, but he didn't explain. What is so marvelous about God and for God that he has no explanations to give? He speaks, it's up to us to explain. But that is part of the Jewish tradition. We believe that God gave the law. Once the law has been given, actually it implies his own consent and collaboration. Sometimes when our sages argue with God, they use his law to question his behavior. God could say, come on, I gave it, it's not for me to obey it. But they say, oh no. They say, oh no, since you gave it, you must obey it. But then the next phase is, God gave the law, and it's up to us to interpret it. And our interpretation is valid, even in God's eyes. So what about Adam and Eve, really? God said, don't do. Why did he do that? Had Adam and Eve questioned God, Mr. God, you don't want us to eat, tell us why. It would have been all right. But they didn't question, and that was their first mistake. God said, don't, and then they found out that since if you eat, then maybe you will become like us, meaning the angels. No. Problem began when the serpent, the third participant, entered the stage. It is the serpent who said to Eve, actually, and to Adam, eat from it. You know why God doesn't want you to eat from it? Because God is jealous of you. And Adam was seduced, and so was Eve. Eve was seduced even before Adam. Women always come first. Thank God, by the way. Now we have someone to follow. And they ate, and that's when they discovered the difference between good and evil. So we imagine, therefore, and by the way, this imagination is correct. What is good is moral, and what is evil is immoral. One more question, by the way, is about the serpent. What was his role? And there our commentators say something very, very beautiful. In the beginning, the serpent actually was like a human being. He was the tempter, the seducer, and therefore he, in some mystical text, he was even like Satan. The original statue of the serpent was satanic. But then when God punished Adam and Eve, with exile, what happened to the serpent? So in the Bible it is said that God cursed the serpent. From now on, you will no longer be human. You will have to crawl on the ground and eat dust. Comes a great Hasidic master, the Rabbi of Kotsk. And he said, what kind of punishment is it? He will never be hungry. And the answer is, that will be his punishment, that he will never be hungry. So here we come right away now to our question about morality. If I want to be hungry, it's my choice. But I should not and will not accept you to be hungry. So here, therefore, we start by saying, or by giving you at least a beginning of definition, and say rather what makes us moral, which is, we will come to it, it's easier to ask ourselves what can make us immoral. And I would say, what makes me immoral is when I see someone hungry and I don't feed him or her. And we know, my friends, today, there are at least more than 1 billion people in the world that are hungry. Just hungry. They live maybe on $2 a day. And after all, we who are not hungry don't even think about them. So I continue. Therefore, to be immoral is to be indifferent to someone else's hunger. But that means hungry not only for food. It can be hunger for liberty, hunger for happiness, for love, a hunger for humanity. I think about it these days, and I'll tell you why immediately and right away. We witnessed a terrible event in Iran. Iran is an ancient nation with an ancient culture, except that all of a sudden, a man became its president, Ahmadinejad. And he, to me, I cannot say people are evil. For me, it's difficult to say that. Very few were, and that's because they really were. I can believe that a human being is a human being who can do evil things, and this man is doing evil things to his people and to others. Number one, he is the number one Holocaust denier in the world. The number one, who says it never happened. And then he says, it never happened, but it will happen. And he says how? He wants a nuclear weapon to destroy the state of Israel. Then came the elections, and thank God, a surprise arrived. We saw it on television. Young people, men and women, with open faces, had the courage, the audacity, the moral courage to oppose him and to say no, no, no. And they said so knowing that this man is in control, in total control of the army, of the police, of the secret services, of the security services, of all in Iran that has power. He controls it. And nevertheless, they had the courage to say no. And he stole the elections. What worries me and what pains me is that these young men, not necessarily young, but all men and women, we saw them on television. We heard them. We heard their outcry. And I have not heard enough from the political circles in government all over the world to say to them, look, we are with you. We admire you. We love you. We cannot help you now for all kinds of reasons. But at least you should know that we are on your side. You are not alone. That is immoral. I can tell you from experience. Someone who suffers because he or she is a victim of destiny or a prisoner of social conditions, or simply because somebody is sick, desperately sick, they suffer not only because of what has been inflicted on them, but also because of the very idea that they are alone, that nobody cares. And what? You have young people, old people, who are courageous, facing imprisonment or death. A young woman was killed in the street, and nobody cares. That is already immoral. Then we could say, what is immoral? Then a society or a person actually chooses, because it's always a choice. The law, an immoral society is the one who has total disrespect of the law. When the law itself becomes immoral. And that happened not only in totalitarian countries that used to be Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia. Believe it or not, it happened in our own country here. When I came to America, I came in 56, and a few months later, I was offered by friends of mine, journalists, colleagues, to give me a ride cross-country, to know the country from where I would go to report. And when I came to the South, for the first time in my life, I saw injustice being practiced in the name of the law. I saw a black community there that, because of the color of its skin, has been humiliated day after day after day in every way possible. And then, for the first time in my life, I felt shame. I never felt shame as a Jew. Now I felt shame for being white. Later, I went to South Africa for that reason, to see apartheid at work. And I saw it in the Soweto's. And there again, I felt shame. In both cases, that shame reflected a deep conviction that you cannot humiliate a person in the name of the law. You cannot humiliate a community in the name of so-called justice. You cannot. Because that makes you an accomplice of total immorality. Thank God, in America, the law changed. Racism now is unlawful. Naturally, we have to admit it. It took the death of a president, of his brother, of Martin Luther King, to change that law. But the law is changed. And I was at the inauguration of President Obama. And I cannot tell you what I felt. I'm sure you imagine. I had tears in my eyes. I said, my God, history has now tried to correct its own mistakes. In Iran, are we going to learn from that, as we have learned from racism? As a Jew, I cannot speak about racism without speaking of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is the oldest group prejudice in history. We say that it's as old as our exile. It preceded even exile. You can find anti-Semitic sayings and almost propaganda in the Roman philosophers, Cicero and Horatius. You have already then some anti-Semitic outbursts. And what didn't we try to do in order to avoid it, to escape it, or to change it? It didn't work. A few years ago, I addressed the United Nations. And there I said, if Auschwitz hasn't cured the world of anti-Semitism, what can and what will? But there I went further, I said, has the world learned anything from history, from our history? And my conclusion was pessimistic. It hasn't. Had the world learned, there would have been no Rwanda, no Bosnia, and earlier no Cambodia, and no Darfur. So what else can we do to make the world open to learning? Call it education. And I, as a teacher and a student, I never stopped learning. I continue teaching. It's because I love learning. My passion for learning is what motivates my life. And therefore, I believe, of course, that whatever the question is, and whatever the answer is, education must be its major component. But if education doesn't help, what do you do? One of the darkest moments in my life was after the war, when I discovered in the archives that the commanders of the infamous Einsatzkommandos, they were special murder squads that followed the Wehrmacht and sometimes with the Wehrmacht, killed and killed and killed with machine guns, men, women and children, hundreds and thousands a day. Many of them had college degrees, my God, college degrees from the most prestigious universities in Germany. And some of them even had doctoral degrees in theology, in the arts, in medicine. So if their education did not serve as a shield for them, not to transgress certain human laws, what can and what will? I believe, my expression is in all of my books, and yet. Oh, we could say education is useless, and yet there is nothing else to replace it, whatever it is. Yes, I should give up on humanity because of the inhumanity of the killers, and yet I will never give up on humanity. Oh, I know many things. And yet I will not use my knowledge to condone injustice and immorality. In ancient times, during the emperors, when the emperor died, rather was killed, I don't think there was one single emperor that died in his bed. But the moment he died, the laws, all the laws in the land were abolished with the death of the emperor. And sometimes an emperor was killed precisely for that reason. For that reason, to change the law. And the marvelous Machiavelli, Niccolò Machiavelli, he said at one point in one of his letters, he said, poor tyrant, he speaks of the Roman emperor, poor tyrant or poor emperor. Doesn't the tyrant realize that no one ever succeeded to kill his successor? But they tried. In the Jewish tradition, in Jewish history, that doesn't exist. The law is the law. When David, after all, what other king do we have in our history that has the prestige, the aura, the power, the moral authority than David, in spite, and yet, in spite, David wasn't such a nice man. He wasn't. What he did to Uriah, my God, he fell in love with a beautiful woman. She's right, he fell in love with a beautiful woman. He's human. We know cases in American history that it happened, you know. Okay, it happened, what can you do? But then what he did in order to get her and marry her, he sent Uriah back to the front with his death sentence in the letter to the commander of the front. And nevertheless, David is the one whom God entrusted to build a temple. He didn't finish it because Solomon came. Thank God for that, because Solomon was a man of peace. But nevertheless, David is king. The ancestor of the Messiah is David, king of Israel. Because he too had to pay a price for violating the law. The law is above politics. The law is above anything else. But what do you do when the law becomes unlawful? You change the regime. It's very simple. What we believe was moral, Germany and the Soviet Union believed was immoral. They believed it was moral to kill us. I mean Jews, communists, homosexuals, Jehovah's Witnesses. That was the moral thing to do. In his testament, 3 days before he committed suicide, he still repeated the same thing. He wanted his believers and his genius, evil genius, Goebbels, actually went on saying it. They are doing it not only for Germany's sake, but they are doing it was for the sake of humanity. And that was for him morality. The same is Stalin, and I never compare Stalin to Hitler. But Stalin too, what he did, my God, what this man did to his people. Millions and millions of his people were sent to the Gulag. Intellectuals were killed. So Stalin and Hitler were convinced they were doing it for the sake of our children, our grandchildren. So what can we do to say that they are wrong? What we can do again is to remain ourselves and say whatever you say, we disagree with, and you will never change us. Of course, there were wars. The war against Germany. And then, of course, the Cold War, which, by the way, has problems, moral problems in America. But nevertheless, that means there was a conflict, a moral conflict, not only a political conflict. Here we come to one more question. Is war moral? Is there something we can call a moral war? Is there morality in war? Two or three weeks before the Iraqi war began, I was invited to the White House by Condi Rice, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor. And then the President right away came in. They asked me, what do you think, what should we do? Now, what do I know about war? I know something about war, but from my own personal view, I simply said, Mr. President, why do you ask? He said, well, you know, there's a situation. Saddam Hussein is a dictator, and he has developed weapons of mass destruction. From experience, we know that once he has them, he will use them. What should we do? That was again before the war. And I said, Mr. President, I cannot hear myself say that I am for war, because I know what it means. War means suffering. War means orphans, widows, destruction. I cannot hear myself say that. War is not an option. War cannot be an option. Except if it's a just war. What is a just war? You have it in the Bible, you have it in the Talmudic literature, you have it in Augustine. A lot have been written about just war. To me, the only just war that I can speak of was the war against Hitler. There, if I had been in America, I surely would have volunteered to the army to bear arms and fight Hitler. That's all. So he said, then what should we do? And I said, look, I have spent my adult life to fight for human rights. And we fight for human rights all over the world as we can. Economically, we should. Diplomatically, politically, morally. If the time comes, it becomes a just war. No, the time hasn't come. I don't see it. He said, then what do you call it? I said, I call it intervention. To intervene in another nation's, even domestic, life in order to prevail upon it to be moral. Usually with a community, with a segment of the population. What's the difference, he says? I said, it's very simple. War is a political option. Intervention is a moral option. So therefore, I would say, war, by definition, except when it's a just war, is not moral. Simply because it means, of course, not so much victory. It means suffering for so many people. And above all, for children. And here we come to another element of the definition. A moral society is the one that takes care of its children and of its elderly, of those who need help and protection and compassion. In our country, in America, we are very compassionate. We are, and it should be. Except I believe we don't do enough for our elderly. And I speak already as a senior citizen. I see my way around. When I was young in my little town, you know, I had a grandfather, and I loved my grandfather. And for me, when I saw my grandfather, I used, twice a year during the holidays, I used to travel. Maybe he lived 10 miles away. I would prepare myself for weeks for that meeting. It was so great. And when he would come to us to spend the Sabbath with us, I would give him my bed, because it was, every moment was a moment of joy. What we do in America, at best, we give them old age homes and we send them to Florida. But in my time, to send my grandfather away, they would take him in. As for children, we try a lot, because again, we want to be moral in that respect. Because why is the difference? Because the grandparents symbolize the past. Children symbolize the future. And there are two expressions in America, which I, who love America, I really love this country. There are two expressions I don't like. One, when I came here, they would say, relax. I don't want to relax. I don't want to be involved, agitated, committed, to relax. I teach my students not to relax. And the other one is, we have to move on. I don't like that either. We need to move on. Turn the page and everything is forgotten, everything goes on. Not at all. So therefore, we are kinder to the children than to the elderly, but in so many other parts in the world, children are the first victims. Adults wage war, and children die. My very good friends, I hope, and I say so, do you know that every moment that we spend here together, every moment, look at your watch, somewhere in this world a child dies. Of disease, of hunger, of violence. Every moment. Are we aware of that? And once we are aware of that, what do we do? What else? In a moral society, we respect the past. And we want to remember it as it was, in its sacredness, in its delicacy, in its warmth, and even in its pain. In an immoral society, again like Germany, Nazi Germany, or Soviet Russia, they change history. You could take at that time the encyclopedia, the Soviet encyclopedia, and there you would see 1 year, Trotsky was a hero. After all, a companion of Lenin. Trotsky was the founder of the Red Army. And when Stalin began hating him, he literally, rather than 3 pages, he had 1 page. And then 5 lines. And then no line. Oh no. We are truthful to our history. We must remember what we have done. We in America remember the Civil War. And we remember what we have done in order to bring closer together communities of belief or of affiliation or of social and ethnic origin. Now, therefore, we come actually now to the problem of indifference, which is my favorite subject. I was here years ago. I tried to remember together with Tom. And when I was here, I remember what I spoke about, but I didn't remember the date. I'm good at topics, but not at figures. But I do remember I spoke about Job. Job, one of my favorite books. What a great book. Here is a man, actually, who in the very first paragraph almost says that he was a moral man. He was moral, totally moral, God-fearing and avoiding evil, says the Bible. And then what happened? What happened was that one day, while his 7 sons and 3 daughters were having a party somewhere, he had actually dinner with his wife alone, probably. By the way, his wife's name is never mentioned. I have criticism of the book. This is one of it. After all, he wasn't alone to suffer. She also suffered. And when they lost their children, her children too were lost. And the book is about him and not her. So, parenthesis, years and years ago, I lectured on Job on French television. My language, my working language is French. All my books are written in French first. And I got on television for 2 years, prime time, only in France, prime time, on Job. And I didn't even finish it, because after 2 years, it was enough for me. So the last 20 pages, I went very fast. But then I asked the same question. I said, how come that the book is about him and not her? And I wish somebody were to write the book on her. I got 2 or 3 years later, a letter and a book from a French writer of Lebanese origin. She said, Professor Wiesel, I heard you. This is the book. What is the motive? You know, I ask my students when we teach books, what is the book about? Anything you like. We taught Romeo and Juliet. What is the book about? And usually, all of them say it's about love. True, a love story. Romeo and Juliet loved each other so much that they wanted to die together. And I said, oh, no. It's a book about hatred. Two families hated one another for generations. And who paid the price? Their children. So what is the book about, the book of Job? Usually people say it's about, you know, divine justice versus human compassion, or the other way around, divine compassion versus human concept of justice, divine. Yes, but what is it about, really? About the right to rebel, even against God? Perfect, I love that. Because, again, in an immoral society, no one has the right to question. They live only in certainties, in the absolute. Questions were forbidden, both in communist Russia and in Nazi Germany. Don't ask questions. We give you the answers before the questions. We believe in the right to question. The first question in the Bible, by the way, is when God asks Cain having killed Abel. And again, story within story within story, what a morbid way to begin religious history. There were only two brothers in the world at that time. And one became the killer and or the victim of the other. And I asked, by the way, why? And the answer really is not only to show that it is possible for brothers to become enemies, as we have seen so often later on in our history. I would rather think Scripture wanted to teach us that whoever kills, kills his brother. But then God, all of a sudden, says to Cain, Ayeka, meaning, where are thou? A very great Hasidic master was in jail once, and the warden who knew the Bible asked him, is it possible, is it conceivable that God didn't know where Cain was? My answer is, God knew. Cain did not. Do we know where we are in the world? Do we know where my place is in the world? Do I know what I'm supposed to do with my life? Do I know? To the essential questions in life, I don't have the answers. Only the questions. So therefore, we have there in the Bible the importance of questions. Job is asking questions, saying, come on, I was good. Why do I deserve all this? And here I would say that was his mistake, that he said, I was good. That's already vanity. Only God can say that. Or someone else can say that. Which means my humanity is conditioned by yours. Which means my morality is conditioned not only by your morality, but by your own condition in life. I could say, if I were absolutely, almost fanatically religious, I speak about hunger, I see a hungry person in the street, I could say, by the way, Mr. or Madam, if you are poor and hungry, it's not my fault, ask God. Everything in life, everything in the world is because God wants it that way. So leave me alone. Ask God to change your conditions. I don't have to help you. And there, says a Hasidic source beautifully, he says, everything is, God is in everything. God is even in atheism. Meaning, when you face a moral situation, to help this person or not, don't invoke God. Help him. Even if God wants him or her to be poor, go against God. Help her. And since then, when I go in the street and the person, I see a person with his palm open, I know people tell me, don't give him your dollar because he or she will go and buy alcohol or drugs or something. And I say, no, wait a second. Maybe they are really hungry. And I cannot just leave the palm open. In other words, with Job, his mistake was that he asked, he said, I am good. But for us, the problem is a problem. Why did he suffer? He did absolutely nothing wrong. That you know, in our tradition, Talmudic tradition, he is compared to Abraham. He's compared to Abraham, the father of our religion, God's messenger to mankind. Why did he suffer? And I can only give you the next phase. Next phase actually is Job, in chapter 38, all of a sudden, after he had already argued with his three friends, who weren't such good friends, but he argued with them, God speaks. And God says, where were you when I created heaven and earth and so forth and so forth? At which point, Job almost fell to his knees and said, yes, mea culpa, yes, I sinned, it's my fault and so forth. Why did he do that? Until then, Job's problem was not God's apparent injustice, but God's apparent indifference. The moment God spoke, Job realized that God was not indifferent, that God is not a stranger to his creation, that God cares. So he gave in. And in conclusion, I mentioned Abraham. Was Abraham moral? After all, the first to discover God. If we believe in one God, it's thanks to Abraham. Was he moral? Think about it. He left his home when he was young. He broke his father's cherished idols. And that was moral. And when God asked him to bring Isaac, his beloved son, as an offering, and he said, okay, Hineni, here I am, that is moral. As a father, he didn't do so well. As a husband, he sent Hagar, the servant, away with his child, Ishmael. It's a different kind of morality. In my book, if some of you have read it, you know my book, he was not ready to do it anyway. That he, from the very beginning, knew he was not going to fulfill God's command. But this is for a different lecture. Maybe 10 years from now, I'll come back and say. In conclusion, simply, I believe that morally I am obligated to respect the otherness of the other. I am obligated to believe that human life is sacred. Period. I believe that when a child falls to the ground wounded by a bullet or by an accident, you don't look into that child's pockets for his or her ID, but you help. I believe that suffering inflicted by us or by anyone else is immoral. And I know that there will be questions, I'm sure, about Israel. What is happening in Israel? I, as a Jew, am totally committed to my historic land, which was the land of Abraham and Moses, although Moses had not entered it. I don't live there. I don't live in Jerusalem. But Jerusalem lives in me, and therefore I say, there are certain things there which break my heart. And I believe, together with so many other Israeli leaders, including even the latest one, Netanyahu, in the two-state resolution. Is it possible? It is. I organize very frequently Nobel laureates conferences. For the last few years, I did it together with King Abdullah of Jordan, and I am the one who brought together for the first time Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, and Ehud Olmert, who was then prime minister. And when they met for the first time, they fell into each other's arms for a long, long moment, and we had tears in our eyes. It's possible. I think violence must stop. Terrorism must stop. Surely suicide terrorism, which is a blemish on whatever human story, whatever human life is, they must stop. But it's possible, in spite of everything, or I say, as yet, hope, there too is possible. And that is the moral of the story. Thank you.